You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
It's the Fry-Yay Cocktail with Anna Glowinski.
Now, where were you during COVID? I think this is a question that we're going to be answering for generations to come. But my next guest ended up stranded with indigenous people in Peru. You know, that really is like next level stranding. Brad Fox, he's written a book called Another Bone Swapping Event. Brad, good afternoon. How did you end up in the Peruvian jungle during COVID?
Well, it was meant to be a 10-day trip. I was with a group of people who were studying traditional plant medicine for different reasons. There was a kind of, you know, perfect comic assortment of us. It was, you know, I'm a writer. I was with a therapist who was studying kind of psychedelic therapies, a molecular biologist, an ad agent, and a New York City firefighter. And we had gone to stay with this family whose land is about 4 hours walk from the nearest dirt road in a part of Peru called the Cordillera Escalera, thinking we'd be there just over a week. And about 4 days into the trip, a park ranger showed up because this land where the family lived is inside a national park. So a park ranger showed up because we were off. You know, I didn't even have my phone with me up there. There was no reception anyway. So this guy showed up and informed us that Peru had declared a state of emergency. We were under curfew. The park was closed. There was no domestic travel and international borders would be closed until further notice. So that's how it started.
I mean, it sounds like the setup for a one-liner, you know, all these people totally walk into a national park and a global right pandemic happens. How did you feel and how did the group around you react to this news?
Well, at the beginning, it was kind of panic inducing, but it was also, you know, where we were was so far away from things and it was so strange that the reality of kind of checking on like whether our flights were going to be rescheduled and what was going on. I was trying to get in touch with my family. Just all of that was so bizarre. But it was definitely like at the beginning, it was like, you know, what are we going to do? And then after a few days, it became more practical in the sense that like, how are we going to get out? Like, how are we going to pay the rent in New York? Like, while we're here, like all these kind of things that potentially we're going to be just problems. And then it took a couple of weeks, but that all settled. And then we kind of realized this was a longer thing, you know, because they kept extending the state of emergency by a week, by another week. And then eventually we were like, actually, this is going to be a good long time. And then we were like starting to hear from people back home, you know, where it was sirens 24 hours a day. And it just, the situation in New York started to get worse and worse. And then we started to feel very lucky that we had been there, that we had found, ended up there.
And how about the family that you were staying with? How did they respond to this extended amount of time? And, well, and tell us a bit about them as well. Like, give us, yeah, paint a picture of, you know, who are they? Why are we there with them?
Okay, so the Tapoyimas are a family. They call themselves nativos from Lamas, which is a town in that area, which is kind of like the main urban center of indigenous life in that part of Peru. It's you know, a pre-Columbian community. Anyway, they have been for many generations known for producing curanderos. Like, so Miguel, who was the kind of patriarch of the family when we were there, he was in his early 50s, and his father had been who was known as a palero. So it wasn't somebody who serves ayahuasca, which is, you know, obviously the most famous plant medicine from that area. But his father had a whole kind of pharmacopoeia that he administered to people, would come up and do kind of retreats for a couple of weeks where they would go, they would eat very simply and drink different plant remedies. He had died a year before we got there. And then the grandfather, Miguel's grandfather, was known as a tabaquero, so somebody who treats people with tobacco. And so he had his two sons. So there was Miguel's father and then Miguel's uncle, who was trained in administering ayahuasca, chacruna, the kind of vision inducing brew that makes that whole thing like a global phenomenon. But Miguel's like a guy in jeans and a baseball cap, you know, with just like a warm smile and a sense of humor. He's there with his nephew, Luis, who's like a handsome 24-year-old protege, you know, being trained up in the tradition. Luis's sister, Karen, who was, you know, often like cooking or whatever. We're in just this very simple structure without running water or electricity. And it's about the Tapoyimas, like including, you know, various cousins and people who were there helping, taking care of the land. There was probably like 8 or 9 people. And they were used to foreigners coming to stay with them for a week, as we had been planning to do. It was a very uncommercial center. It wasn't like a, you know, shamanic retreat type of thing. It was a very just simple thing. This family's been doing this for a long time. And it was just because the people that I was with knew them that I was there. And I was kind of dragged along somewhat reluctantly. It was at the beginning, like, you know, nothing could be more ordinary to them than like a handful of foreigners are staying in hammocks in their land. But then once the pandemic started to, you know, unfold, on one hand, this is a place that has a history of, you know, being beset by diseases from outside. I mean, that's kind of what determines the realities in many ways in the indigenous communities in Latin America. So there's that history. There's a kind of skepticism of a lot of stories that come in from outside. And at the same time, there's plantains growing, there's bean fields, there's chickens running around, like we're fine, you know?
And so is that where your imagination went? Because apart from, you know, aside from the actual virus itself, I think one of the worst things during COVID was, you know, sitting there and your brain just went worst case scenario, you know, is this the apocalypse? Is this where I'm going to be, where everything collapses? Now you're in this place. Did your brain go there? And, you know, did you guys feel like, okay, together we could make something work here?
I mean, well, of course, I feel like, yeah, your brain goes to all potential scenarios. And in one way, it's like, so what happens if the grid conks out completely? On one hand, it means that we're pretty isolated anyway, but then we're totally isolated from friends and family and any, you know, familiar world. And so, but at the same time, we are in a place that is like remarkably self-sufficient. You know, I mean, there's a spring that has perfectly clean mountain water running down the land. There's fruit, there's vegetables, there's, you know, there's rivers with fish. Like, I mean, we're, it is in one way an ideal spot to be stuck. Like, there's not a whole lot of people around. It's very easy to, you know, socially distance. And so, I mean, and then it became more a question of like, what's the meaning of all this and where does it go and who are we going to be from now on? And you know, I mean, it's like it had been a question of being used to sleeping alone 10 minutes or 15 minutes walk from another person out in the jungle and hearing animals at night and kind of trying to integrate that into my reality to this completely other scenario.
And you know, you're a bunch of people, some of them you knew a little bit better than others and some not at all. How did you all end up gelling during this experience?
Yeah, we became family. So I should say one of the people there was I was married to. We've since split up, but we were at the time married and we went there together as a couple. And so my now ex-wife, Esther, she knew the molecular biologist she is a therapist and the molecular biologist had been a client of hers. They were no longer clients and had maintained a kind of friendly relationship and shared an interest in these types of things. They were both healers in their particular ways of understanding what that meant. So the biologist was married to the ad agent, and then the firefighter had been with Esther, my ex-wife, on an earlier trip to visit Miguel and the family. He was also studying to administer, like with the intention of administering plant medicine. He is a Black American, and felt that there wasn't a lot of access to that stuff in the Black community and kind of felt like that might be a thing that he did. So everyone had gone there with their own reasons. And then we're there and with the Tupolimas, and Esther and I were the two that spoke Spanish. So the others spoke Hungarian. They're Hungarian, some of them. And the firefighter American spoke a little Spanish, but mostly English. So there was that language reality. The Tupolimas are moving between Spanish and Quechua. But you know, pretty soon it was very friendly from the beginning. And just this matter of taking care of simple things, of cooking together, just kind of thinking about what's going on, created, you know, it was surprisingly kind of friendly and good natured pretty quickly.
It also sounds like a fairly good setup, you know, in a potentially post apocalyptic world. You've got a healer, a firefighter, some self-sustaining families. If you could like go into this scenario knowing what could happen and you could pick and choose from society which people you'd have with you, who would you choose?
Yeah, exactly. Miguel, for example, at one point while we were there, his brother broke his arm. And so they used the traditional plant remedies to set his arm and get it back on the road to healing. And there are plant remedies that address bone strength and, you know, circulation and the types of things that you need to get to treat a broken arm, you know? So on one hand, it's like, people are going down into this world looking for, you know, spiritual insights or whatever. But a lot of it is also just practical, where we learn, for example, that as I'm answering your question in a certain way, but that we learn, for example, that tobacco, you blow tobacco as you walk around in the jungle because it alerts the animals of your presence. So it like protects you from poisonous snakes and these types of things. And so there was something about the simplicity of what was going on that became paramount. And so definitely a firefighter, and Nafis, the firefighter, also was an electrician. So he would know how to like wire things up and whatever. I had a lot of practical skills. And Luis knew how to slaughter a chicken. People knew how to, you know, grow beans and when to harvest the plantains. And these things are all, you know, become of vital importance.
And I have to ask you, though, about the healing of the broken arm. How did that compare to Western medicine?
Well, the results? I should say that and most of it happened when I knew Miguel's brother and was around when it started, but I saw him a while afterwards and he was well, but I wasn't there kind of like during the day-to-day treatments. Like I knew what he was using. I knew the plants that he was using. So I can't speak about it a lot of authority other than to say, you know, a year later he's working.
He's got use of his arm.
Yeah.
Tick that box. All right. So moving on to the book now, you call it Labyrinthine and Comic. When did you decide to turn this experience into a book, and why did you decide to write it in that way?
I'm a writer, so, you know, that's my way of seeing things and that's my work. And so, I would never have thought or wanted to write a book about like a visit to the jungle, psychedelics, any of these types of things were not. It was Esther, my ex-wife, like brought me in the sense that she was like, just trust me. I know you're going to appreciate this. And I was a little bit like, shamanic tourism, whatever. But then when we were there, I was like, well, this is just, I mean, with the pandemic and everything and, you know, seeing how Miguel responded to the pandemic, then, for example, Sylvia, the molecular biologist, wanted to interview Miguel because just to ask him, she was also trained as a pharmacist. So she was somebody who felt very familiar with this idea of using substances to heal in a totally different training. And so I was the translator for those conversations. And that happened in a few different circumstances where I ended up being the translator between Miguel and other people who were talking to him about things. And then at some point, you know, we'd been there long enough and it was just objectively interesting, you know, having this occasion to walk through the jungle with this guy who had vast knowledge of this particular corner of the planet and just ask him questions. And here are the stories and the histories of like, you know, his family, how they had experienced things from that part of the world. And so as people eventually many months later started to leave, I started to like debrief, like do these kind of exit interviews with, so I would sit down with Sylvia and talk to her for 6 hours before she left. And with the understanding that if I ever did it, like they knew I was a writer, you know, I was like, if I ever do anything, you know, we'll talk about it. I'm not just going to publish your intimate stories without permission or whatever. So there was that aspect of it. And then I felt like the things that interested me was history and politics, how these things are entangled in what's going on in the greater world. It's not an ahistorical, isolated reality. It's a reality that is part of everything. And so how to see it in that way. And I mean, you gotta have an eye for comedy. You know what I mean? Just like people are so out of their element. And then naturally there's a lot of people, you know, come to this situation with a lot of preconceptions and kind of fantasies about what a shaman is and what, you know, what they're going to learn and that type of thing. And even you could say the plants themselves kind of quickly disabuse you of that. And often it can be beautiful. It can be frightening, but it can also be hilarious. And I wanted to like bring that into the story, you know?
And so obviously you talked about your experience in the book. That's like the crux of it. And then there's other parts that are woven in, you know, the shamanism and the survivalism. But you also mentioned that you have an interest in politics and how that weaves in. But it's not something that we've touched on at all. So how do you bring that into your book?
Well, I mean, I have a background in, I spent my 20s, like in the late 90s, early 2000s in the former Yugoslavia. I worked, as a journalist and as a relief worker. And I did contracts like that here and there and other places in Turkey. And so to me, being like a American, a person from the heartland, that from the suburbs, that was very kind of sheltered from a lot of realities, especially American foreign policy, that was a huge education for me. And that formed so much about how I saw what was happening in the world. And so I always was looking for how our personal lives and fates are intertwined with these greater historical forces, which are sometimes natural, sometimes the cumulative effect of many human decisions. And so that's an aspect of how I see also why the Tapuimas are in that situation, what's happening in that mountain. Like, all of these things have their own history and politics as well.
And, you know, I want to end the interview with a question about the present right now and about you. You're obviously someone who likes to think about things. You must spend a lot of time in your head. Does it make a lot of difference where you are? You know, are you happy to be back in the modern world, or are there parts of that lifestyle that you miss?
Well, right now I am in the New York Public Library at 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue. So I'm kind of like in the absolute belly of the beast in some way. I miss New York a lot when I was there. I mean, I've been back to see Miguel and the family twice since leaving in 2021. And there's something so amazing about just being back in that spot of jungle that became home to me. There's no question that it's a huge influence just to breathe that air and hear those sounds and you know, speak that language and be in the sensibility of that family. And so obviously that's very different than the carnival of New York City where I live, you know, in the midst of, you know, authoritarian meltdown and all kinds of other disasters. So yeah, I mean, it makes a huge difference. It's like, I guess it's all to me unbelievably fascinating, and to try to get my mind around about how these realities fit together and connect is a source of endless fascination.
Well, you know, you've done your best. You've put it pen to paper. You've put it into a book. The book is now out there. It's called Another Bone Swapping Event. You can find it on Amazon or the Talk Radio Europe bookshop by Brad Fox, who we've just been speaking to today. Brad, thank you and bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team. with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18-plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.